Hello, this is Paul Evans, former clerk in the House of Commons. I'm taking modules 11 and 12 of the course, and this podcast relates to module 11 about understanding Parliament. In it, I talk to Professor Emma Crewe, who has pioneered an ethnographic approach to understanding Parliament, particularly working with looking at the way the organism of Parliament, as rather than the organisation, the village of Westminster, looks from the perspective of the backbench MP. And I hope it will help you understand the forces that are at work, that individual members have to deal with, individual MPs and peers, and give you a sense of what makes Parliament tick. Today I'm talking to Professor Emma Crewe, who is an anthropologist or ethnographer, I'm not quite sure which she would prefer to describe herself as, who has in the last decade or so made a particular specialism of studying the two houses of Parliament. And the reason I'm talking to her is I want to give people on this course a sense of what it really feels like to be a parliamentarian, because I think Emma's work has probably been the stuff that has most clearly explained the inner life of Parliament to the world outside, rather than the external life. So I'm going to begin, Emma, if I may, by asking you in that context, what do you think people need to understand about parliamentarians and their lives to get a sense of what makes them tick? And perhaps what most surprised you when you were doing your research in the two houses?
Yes, it might be helpful if I explain my approach to research. So for me, anthropology is a discipline, an academic discipline, that's really interested in relationships between people. So we study social worlds. Sometimes that might be communities, or sometimes that might be organizations. Whereas ethnography is more about the way that we do research. So it's more about the method, which is always paying attention to what people actually do in real life together, the way they talk to each other, what kind of work they try and do, if it's in an organisation, what do they fight about, who do they marry, that kind of thing. So when you ask me to think about how parliamentarians tick, the ticking that I feel is a bit neglected by political science is in this area of relationships and interaction. So we know a lot about what Parliament is like as an institution or a system or a structure and what it produces in terms of outputs. And we know a fair amount about how people behave as individuals. But what I feel is missing, and what I think anthropology has to offer, is an understanding of how people are ticking together. So what are they doing in groups? And what really surprised me about studying Parliament is how extraordinarily different it looks behind the front stage, if you like. So the House of Lords, for example, looks very intimidating and formal. And because the average age is quite high, I assumed that it would be a place of misogyny, a very unfriendly place, and a place where people were extremely self-important. And actually, once I got talking to people and watching and doing a little bit of work for the clerks, for example, in the House of Lords, I discovered that it's a really intimate place. It's like a little village, because people are there for life, just like a village. Of course, people do fight, but they're very conscious of the fact that when they fall out with each other, they're going to be stuck with this person for decades. It's not a place of misogyny at all. Women, I would say, even outperform men in the House of Lords. Very often, the women who've got there have had to fight very hard through long careers in pretty hostile environments. But also, it's not where as much political power is fought over. It's not the primary chamber, it's the secondary chamber. So it can be a much gentler place. So completely different from what I expected. In the House of Commons, I think I was most surprised by how rebellious MPs are. So Phil Cowley had already done loads of work on how backbench, particularly backbench government MPs, have got more and more rebellious since the 1950s. And so I got really, really curious about why this was, because people talk about the House of Commons as this very tribal place, and constituents often complain that MPs should be following what they want, not following the instructions of their party. But actually, they're not following the instructions of their party quite a lot. Obviously, the in the main, they are like teams. You know, I used to work for a charity, and when working for a charity, you have to be on message. And in the same way, when you belong to a political party, in the main, you have to be on message. But I was fascinated by how often people either voted against the whip or, more significantly, really threatened to. So a lot of things don't happen in the House of Commons because the whips are rushing around to see what will get past the backbenchers. And the backbenchers are continually saying, no, 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 we're not going to support that. So actually, there's a lot of negotiation and kind of intelligence work that goes on behind the scenes that we don't see, and that makes you realise how extraordinarily complex politics is.
Thank you, Emma. And there's a lot of ideas there which I'm going to pick up on, I hope, in the course of this short conversation. But tribes, you mentioned, and of course the obvious tribes that we all see are the parties. But are there other tribal divisions in the House of Commons in particular, you think?
There are many configurations, and what makes them different actually from tribes or ethnic groups or lineages or whatever is that they, well, many of them anyway, is the fluidity of them. So you do have some groups which have more continuity over time. So political parties, on the whole, are at least for that parliament, are pretty constant. People do change occasionally, they cross the floor of the House. But on the whole, you've come into the House of Commons on a particular party ticket, if you like. So to change is pretty controversial. There are other groups, as you say, which are much more fluid. So you get groups that are organised around particular pieces of legislation or particular policy issues. So people who've been social workers, even across different political parties, will come together to represent the interests of social workers. Or people who have worked with children might coalesce around a particular piece of legislation, and very often they'll kind of, there's a kind of reciprocal deal making that goes on behind the scenes. And although most of the deals, by which I mean the kind of understandings, well, if you support my amendment, I'll support yours, most of that goes on within parties, but quite a lot goes on between parties. The groups that I'm really fascinated by are select committees. So in a way, the select committees, which are organised to scrutinise government and also to run inquiries on important topics, become like little mini teams, and they have to be from different parties, but they're not only politicians, they're also the officials who run the committees. And these select committees have really, really grown in influence. They've become much, much more important and even get some media attention. There are other groups, again, that are made up not only of MPs or of peers, but them and people in the outside world. But very obviously, things like all-party parliamentary groups are coordinated by charities, for example. So there are groups formed around various different informal APPGs. But also, you know, if you look in constituencies, there are all kinds of configurations that go on there. And actually, when MPs are running their constituency offices, they have to develop an extremely deep knowledge and set of connections with people who can help them to try and solve the problems that are presented to them in constituency surgeries. So there are all sorts of really, really complex sort of group formations.
You talked about your surprise, in a way, at the culture you found in the House of Lords. Did you find when you moved on to the House of Commons that the culture was very different there?
The two houses could not be more different. I mentioned that the House of Lords is rather village-like, partly because people are there, mostly there for life, but also because it's smaller. They haven't got as many offices, and they haven't got the connections to the constituencies. So in a sense, the House of Lords is much more contained. The House of Commons is like a completely hectic city where there are a million different things going on within Westminster, but it's also got this constitutional connection with the whole of the rest of the nation. So it creates a completely different culture, partly because of this complexity and the fact that it's reaching across the nation. But it's also a much, much, much more competitive place. So the political competition between MPs, who are all vying to get promotion within their party, because very, very often politicians go into politics because they want to make a difference, or because they're really angry at something they see going on and they want to go and change it. And they know that to have a really strong influence on policymaking, legislation and the administration of government, they have to get into government. They need a government position. So they're extremely competitive against each other. And that culturally makes for a totally different domain. And one of the things that people, I think, misunderstand about what goes on in the House of Commons is that they think the nasty politics goes on between parties, but actually it gets much, much nastier within parties, because you're competing against actually your friends and colleagues who you work with over years and years and years. So one minute you're canvassing together on the streets of Finsbury or wherever it is, and then the next minute somebody's got to be appointed to the front bench, and you're in competition against each other. This is not different from, you know, I work in a university where to some extent the same sort of thing goes on, but it goes on in a way in Parliament with much, much more at stake. So, you know, they are responsible for administering government, which still remains extremely influential on our lives. So there's much more at stake in the competition, but also these people are really, really exposed. No one notices me, but you do anything as a politician and someone's noticing, at least locally, someone's going to notice. And the journalists pick up on the strangest, tiny little details of people's lives that are revealed, for example, by your expenses, which are now very transparent. So it's very, very much more competitive than most domains. And the competitors are very exposed to public scrutiny.
And of course, that promotion system, interim and then the dismissal from government, doesn't really follow what we would call best HR practice of fair and open competition or anything else. It's a much more precarious life, I think, there than even in the universities. You've done a case study on a bill which you refer to some of these things, which I certainly draw to the attention of the people listening to this as something they could go away and read to learn more about what you've talked about. But and you've touched on this already, that there is a public and theatrical dimension to Parliament that we all see, and then there is a private and a largely unseen one. And you've touched on it, but how important do you think that unseen private world of Parliament is to what actually comes out of in the end in terms of policy and scrutiny and all the other things it's supposed to be doing?
It's very important, and I think one of the reasons why it's politically significant is that people, I don't think, realise quite how influential civil society is on legislative process. And the reason why that matters is because as citizens, we need to have enough optimism about the influence we might have in order to engage. So the clause that I watched was of particular interest and was rather controversial because it was all about what happens to children when you have a family breakdown and the carers of the children can't sort it out themselves, so they go to court. So this little clause was about what should the court advise or decide on behalf of children. And it did get very controversial, but what was interesting was that the very sensible amendments that were made to this piece of legislation were actually the product of a lot of collaboration between people in children's organisations, lawyers, social workers, children's guardians, etc., and politicians. But inevitably, politicians need to take the credit for things because it is a very competitive world and they are trying to advance not just themselves, but also their causes. And the other reason why politicians also often get the credit for things is because if you look at the text, the legal text, of course, their name is on the text. So if I give an example, there was one very important amendment which made a clarification to this clause. And if you look at all the legal texts, it shows that Baroness Butler-Sloss was the one who moved this amendment in the House of Lords. But actually, it was drafted by a young paralegal in a children's charity called Hazel, you know, sitting in Bloomsbury. But of course, her name wouldn't appear on the text. So I think it is important to recognise the hard work that goes on behind the scenes, because there are a cast of thousands who are involved in influencing politicians. And of course, this happens in legislation, but it also happens in constituencies. And actually, the influence of constituents is becoming stronger and stronger. And politicians are responding to that by interacting more and more and more with them. And actually, I think this raises some questions about how we make that engagement as generative and as productive as possible. Because at the moment, it just feels like there's a huge amount of it, but I don't think we as citizens are very good at holding our own MPs to account for the way in which they engage with us. So there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes that I think is worth researchers shining the spotlight on, but I think also is worth citizens getting engaged and finding out about for themselves.
Thank you. That's I think, a really important lesson to understand how much is going on out. There is Parliament and there is government, there are ministers, and there are elected members, but there's a whole lot else going on behind the scenes. You spent a little, just as a last question, you've become quite intrigued by select committees over the course of your research and their internal dynamics in particular, in many ways. So we're talking here to Treasury civil servants who are going at some point in their career probably to have to either advise a minister or themselves appear before a select committee. If you were advising a civil servant who was going before a select committee, what key piece of advice would you give them about how to handle it? I know it's different for every committee, but are there some key overarching things that you would say are the way to approach that challenge of sitting in front of a committee, a very intimidating experience?
I wouldn't like to advise a civil servant, particularly if they've had experience of doing this, because I think they are absolutely mistresses and masters at dealing with a very, very complicated situation where often politicians are trying to wriggle out of taking the blame for things. Civil servants can't blame their own bosses. So they need to deal with a very complex situation of accountability, a process of accountability with tact, and with respect, but also not sort of succumbing to the devious tactics of the politicians. So I think the experienced ones have to do two really interesting things. One is an extraordinary amount of research. So they have to have an answer to anything that might get thrown at them. And they don't necessarily get warning about exactly what they're going to be asked about. So their research has to be partly about their own department, but they also have to do research on the Select Committee and what it's interested in and what inquiries it's already done on that topic and what evidence it's already had. And the second thing that I think, not just civil servants, but anyone giving evidence has to do when they're talking to politicians, is recognise that it is an intimidating experience and it's also quite emotional. So you can find yourself getting quite exasperated and angry, or rather alarmed and anxious. And I think that noticing that that's completely normal and that's the situation for everyone, but also really developing a skill at dealing with the emotional difficulty of giving evidence to an intimidating group of people who are backed up by these scarily well-informed clerks and officials in the committee office, is actually quite an important part of the task. So I'm really interested in how politics does get very emotional, and the skill of doing it therefore means you have to become good at improvising even when you're feeling quite emotional.
That's quite a challenge. Thank you very much, Emma. That was absolutely fascinating. And is there anything else you wanted to add, or shall we get Kirsty to turn off the recording now?
The final thing that I think is worth saying is that to understand politicians, I'm interested in the way that they do politics, by which I mean that they encounter disputes, conflicts, differences with other people and try and find a resolution to them and come to agreements and work out solutions with each other. But they do it in a way which is even more amplified than the rest of us. So I think we all do politics when we're in organisations. We even do politics in the family. But it's not normally as fraught and as exposed as politicians' work is. And I think that's quite important to understand, because we tend to look down on politicians. We tend to get very angry with them. We get disappointed with them. But if we remember that we actually do politics ourselves in any organisation we're in, and sometimes we do it well, sometimes we do it rather badly, then I think it will make us a little bit more sympathetic towards politicians and what they're trying to do. But at the same time, I don't think that should mean we close down our criticism of them. I think we do need to scrutinise them, and we need to hold them accountable, but we need to do that in a way that has a very clear understanding of the nature of their work and what politics actually involves. So in a way, what I'm arguing for is a greater respect for politics, and sometimes even for the practitioners of it, because I think that really will help us to engage with politics ourselves.
Thank you, Emma. In defence of politics.
Exactly.